This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome back to The Morning Run. You're here with Lynn Mark, Roshan Kanison and Noel Lim. It's 8:36 in the morning at Monday, the 25th of January. And in about 10 minutes, we're going to be diving into containment strategies to mitigate the spread of COVID-19 and the impact on the economy. But before that, let's take a look at US politics. Because on his first day in office, President Joe Biden certainly wasted no time in carrying out some of his campaign promises.
He has signed a flurry of executive orders concerning COVID-19, the environment and immigration. To name a few. For example, he made wearing a mask mandatory on all federal grounds. He also put the US back into the World Health Organization and the Paris Climate Agreement.
And of course, he repealed the ban on travel from several majority Muslim nations. Now, this has been seen as a clear move to reverse various Trump policies. But what significance does this carry and what can we expect next from the Biden administration? For more insight this morning, we're speaking with Dr. Gaurana Gurgic, lecturer in US politics and foreign policy at the United States Studies Center. Gaurana, thank you so much for joining us today. President Biden's signed various executive orders ranging from immigration to environment, most of which he campaigned on. Which do you find to be the most significant? Or perhaps was there anything that you found particularly noteworthy?
Well, thank you for having me. And it's indeed been a very busy start of the 46th presidency in the United States. So Joe Biden has made this pledge that in the first 10 days in office, he will act on what he called are the four critical pillars of his agenda, primarily dealing with the public health crisis, then dealing with the economic fallout of the pandemic, and then climate change, as well as issues of racial justice and immigration. So those four are kind of the four broad areas where we've seen the flurry of the executive orders that have already been signed over the past couple of days. What I think is probably most significant is the U-turn in terms of the federal directives regarding the governance of the response to the coronavirus pandemic. Some of these things that seem very obvious, like, you know, mandating mask wearing and similar, that will hopefully help somewhat stem the spread of the virus in the United States. But in terms of the kind of global significance of some of these early moves, I think that where we've seen most progressive sort of policies are in terms of the climate action. And here, Joe Biden is signaling to the world that the United States will do serious action on what is the greatest existential threat to the world post-pandemic, for sure.
Now, when we take a look at executive orders in general, they are looked as a slightly controversial in the sense that because it bypasses Congress, and Republicans have pushed back on Biden's executive actions, as Democrats did with President Trump 4 years ago, and so forth, and beyond that, even with Barack Obama. How are Democrats defending the use of executive orders in this time?
That's absolutely right. So from the academic perspective, obviously, executive orders are something that obviously is vested in the power of the presidency. So the Article 2 of American Constitution obviously gives presidents this right to direct the federal bureaucracy to act in specific ways, given that they are the chiefs of the executive branch. Obviously, executive orders, executive action in general, doesn't have the power of legislative action. So as you've rightly pointed out, we've seen now time and time again when we have changes from one party to another in the White House, we see basically doing and undoing of the executive action. What we have to keep in mind is that President Donald Trump was particularly active when it comes to some of the executive orders he has issued. So for Joe Biden, basically the way to deal with that legacy and to undo some of the very harmful policies was precisely with executive orders. But Joe Biden, obviously hailing from a kind of long history of legislative experience, understands that executive orders are no replacement for meaningful legislative action. And so in that way, what we are going to see is much more of an effort and push to try to seal and cement some of these directives into legislation once the Congress gets up and running in kind of full steam after the impeachment trial, after all of the confirmations are done, and hopefully find a way to deal with the Republicans in the Senate, especially on matters that are top of the agenda.
Right now, when we take a look at the past two presidents, largely it looked like the executive orders were used because they didn't have, let's just say, collaborative either Congress or Senates under their when they were in there during their administrations. Do you see that now that we have essentially a blue Congress, a blue Senate, and a blue White House, that the use of executive orders will not be as prominent as they have been in the last 12 years?
Well, one would certainly hope so, but obviously, if we take a look at actually the kind of power balance in the Congress, right, both in the House of Representatives and the Senate, we see that things are quite competitive there. Obviously, we can't stop talking about, you know, how hyper partisan the United States has become and how that partisanship really rules the sort of political relations. And in that sense, the kind of adversarial nature of the system determines the ability of any president to enact their agenda. So in other words, that means that even though at the first blush, we see that Democrats control now the legislature and the executive branch, the margins in the Congress are pretty slim. The Senate is 50-50 basically, but 51 given that the vice president holds that casting vote. So the vice president Kamala Harris will come in if things get kind of tied in the Senate. And in the House of Representatives, actually the margin is pretty small given that Democrats have lost seats in the 2020 election rather than gain them on the coattails of Joe Biden. So in that sense, we will need to see how, you know, the following months proceed. What is the deal that, for instance, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell strike, what kind of deal and mode of operation they will have, and whether we will see at least some sort of opening for a bit more bipartisanship. I wouldn't hold my breath on that. And this is precisely why even, you know, President Obama was only able to push so much through the kind of legislative process in those first 2 years. Similar to that, you know, President Trump had the big tax cuts, but he wasn't able to undo some of the legislative legacy of President Obama, or to actually enact much through the Congress, given that 2018 midterms basically swung the House of Representatives towards Democrats. So in saying that, basically, We just will have to wait, see the extent to which some of the planned agenda, you know, the kind of priorities, the way that plays out. And obviously the ability of President Biden to do what he has promised, and that's to unite the country and to try to basically offer all sides something that they can sign on to if he wants to get things done as packages of legislation rather than just executive action.
Given the polarized nature of the US, a successor could also opt to undo Biden's policies. Are we entering an era where deep polarization will result in flip-flop of US policy and therefore impacting the reliability of the US as an international partner?
This is certainly something that a lot of allies and partners of the United States have been wondering, the question of how much the U.S. can be trusted if the system operates basically on some of the quirks of the Electoral College, or if indeed, you know, we see basically some of the negative developments in terms of, say, reapportionment of districts in the United States, you know, the gerrymandering determining basically the makeup of the Congress and basically making it kind of strongly anti-majoritarian and in that way just amplifying the partisanship that I've talked about. This is something that has not just emerged out of nowhere. It's not certainly just the legacy of the Trump era. That sort of intense partisanship is basically part and parcel of the more competitive inter-party relations in the United States going back to already 70s, but really kind of gaining steam in the 90s during the Clinton administration. If you recall the 1994 midterms, the so-called Gingrich revolution, and then extending basically to this day and age. It's not easy to be an optimist, but as many have pointed out, if there is a kind of figurehead that could be a uniter, probably Joe Biden is that figure, given again his track record as both a prominent senator who has worked across the aisle, so to speak, as well as then during his time in the seat of the vice president under the Obama administration, as well, yes, being a very important congressional liaison. So to just wrap it up, time will tell, but certainly we know that partisanship, hyper-partisanship, especially in the United States, isn't going anywhere anytime soon.
Thanks so much for speaking with us this morning, Gaurana. That was Dr. Gaurana Gergic at the United States Studies Center, based in the University of Sydney, talking to us about how partisanship really is here to stay and a little bit about what we can expect out of this Biden administration. Now, up next, is there a chance that we might see stricter measures to combat COVID-19? And we'll be speaking about that with Dr. Carmelo Frilito, CEO of the Center for Market Education. Stay tuned for that after these messages. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.